Everybody, welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Coming up, the Syrian peace process is wasted breath, rebels say. The Israeli prime minister makes a controversial political change. Pictures drawn by child Hiroshima survivors are returned to the artists in a new documentary. And the British-based trio Above and Beyond is touring with a total acoustic setup. It's all on today's edition, right here. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Right now, we're having a bit of a technical problem, and I can see our wonderful staff in there is jumping around, doing the best they can to solve the problem. And we hope to bring you our report from Jamie Detmer about the Syrian rebels as soon as it is available. In the meantime, I'm very fortunate to be joined by Andrew Palchevsky, our social media reporter. And he's live here in the studio at the anchor desk with me. And thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, as always.
Well, we were talking a little earlier about all the U.S. political news, and I don't have any reports on this today. We had it yesterday. But even overnight, there's more going on in the race for the White House. The Republican people trying to get Trump in, and the Democrats, they haven't chosen a nominee yet, but what's the latest on the web?
Well, we've got lots to talk about, which is good while our folks work out our technical issues.
But they're working away in there. I can see them.
We'll start with the breaking news, just confirmed by the Associated Press, that Donald Trump has officially captured the 1,237 delegates needed to get the Republican nomination. Now, there's no primaries or anything today, so it's not through a nominating contest. It's some of those unpledged delegates who have announced they're going to support Trump. So that's why we're getting to that 1,237 and surpassing it. A lot of people on social media saying, didn't he already have the nomination? Or why are we talking about this now?
But he acts like he did.
He, you know, for all intents and purposes had it, but now officially he has the nomination. So that news just coming out on the Associated Press. They actually just tweeted it out, which is where I saw it on Twitter.
And there's a lot of more going on the web with the U.S. political process.
Absolutely. Hashtag Bernie Trump debate. Now, this idea kind of percolated up from maybe the campaigns or maybe social media. I'm not exactly sure where, but it is a trending hashtag on social media today. The idea being that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump should have a debate.
And Bernie invited this on himself.
Yeah, well, it's
I wouldn't want to debate Trump.
Well, this is the debate, the debate about the debate is, on social media at least, is who does this benefit and who does this hurt? Now, some people saying for Bernie Sanders, it helps him because it makes him look like the nominee. But usually, you only have these debates between the two parties when the Republicans have a nominee and the Democrats have a nominee. Bernie's not the nominee yet. In fact, he has fewer delegates than Hillary Clinton. So it would make him look like the nominee. So they're saying it could be beneficial for him. However, like you said, does he really want to go up against Trump? That's what a lot of people are questioning, saying, does he really want to go into kind of the lion's den?
Yeah, really. There's some big teeth in that den.
Yeah.
And also, we could mention that Clinton decided not to have another debate with the other candidate. Sanders.
Right, so they're wondering, they look like this would hurt Hillary Clinton. That's what a lot of her supporters are saying. They think that this would not be a good thing. For Donald Trump's side of the equation, his supporters are saying, yeah, let's go at it. The more FaceTime, the better. But other people are saying, do we really want to give away all of our best lines on Bernie Sanders, who might not even get the nomination? So lots of back and forth on hashtag Bernie Trump debate. We'll see if it actually comes to fruition. Both candidates said they'd be willing to do it, and they would donate the money from the debate to charity. So, and a lot of people saying, you know, I don't like either of the candidates, but I would definitely watch this. This would be something to watch.
Too.
It would be an event for sure.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
Syrian rebel commanders and opposition politicians are conceding that their armed revolution against President Bashar al-Assad cannot win. Correspondent Jamie Detmer is following developments in the region from Turkey, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Jamie.
Thanks for having me on, Susan.
What are the rebels and the opposition saying, and why?
Well, I've talked to various rebel commanders. I keep in touch with them over, you know, the last 4 years, actually, longer. Their mood is that they're saying that on the battlefield, because of the Russian intervention and the Iranian intervention and the forces of Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia movement, which is backing President Assad as well, they can't win. They recognize that. There's not a military solution to this six-year-long running civil war. Equally, they're saying, however, that unless the Russians, for example, put in huge forces of their own, the regime can't win militarily either. So we're in a stalemate position, they're saying, where we have a de facto partition of the country, the rebels holding part of it, the regime holding more of the western areas and towards the coast, and of course the Islamic State in Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor. We have a partition of the country, and there is no political solution on the horizon that they can see.
You were kind of referring to that, but the talks to end the six-year war in Syria, well, they don't look like they're in good shape. Where do they stand right now?
The UN is trying to get the fourth round since January of the Geneva-based peace talks. First of all, I ought to emphasize, in all of that time, in the previous three rounds, the different sides didn't sit at the same table. These are proximity talks where the UN envoy has to, you know, rush between them as a go-between. And what I'm being told by negotiators, rebel negotiators, is that they feel they're being pressured to agree that President Assad can be part of some kind of transition government. And they're saying, absolutely, that's their red line. They will not accept it. There are various other ideas floating around, like having four super deputies for Assad so he doesn't have complete control. That's being rejected as well. In the end, the fundamental issue is whether Assad goes or stays. And at the moment, the regime is saying he is going to stay, and Iran and Russia are not backing away from him. And equally, the rebels are saying, after 6 years of war, after so much bloodshed, after hundreds of thousands of dead, they will not accept Assad staying.
And what about the long-suffering Syrian refugees? You've been following them and reporting on the horrible situation they're in. What is it like there? What's going on now for them?
Terrible, really. I mean, 6 years, a lot of these refugees or internally displaced people I have known for years. I've seen their moods go up and down. At the moment, there is real despair. They are exhausted. They are tired. We're seeing more and more, particularly the educated young, leaving for Europe or wanting to go there and finding any way they can, even despite this Turkey-EU migrant deal. They don't see any end to this war. Equally, if you ask them whether they're prepared to accept Assad staying, they say no. They don't have any life. They feel in limbo, as one of them said to me last night, a civil society activist I've known for a very long time, is saying, there is no life here for us. You know, we're insecure, we have no future, we have to go. And that's being replicated, of course, amongst the refugees in Jordan and in Lebanon as well. The same kind of sentiments.
What about something like a UN-imposed freeze on the fighting, where the United Nations or NATO or some international organization comes in to impose the peace while this is all sorted out?
I was going to say imposed by whom. I don't think anyone is rushing into this cauldron. You know, this dizzying array of different forces. No one is stepping up to the plate to do it. Surely I don't think there are any signs the Europeans or the Americans or, you know, in the international community as a whole wants to step into this. There's been some talk recently that the Turks may, you know, lose their patience on this and go in. There's no sign of this. So, no, I mean, in the end, this is just going on, much as the Lebanese civil war did, which I remind you went on for 15 years. In the end, that stopped because of sheer exhaustion and because of all the outside players deciding they'd had enough too.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jamie. I appreciate you speaking with us today from Turkey.
Pleasure being on. Thank you, Susan.
In the news, Obama says world leaders are rattled by possible Trump presidency. Families fleeing Fallujah are in a state of shock, according to the Norwegian Refugee Council. France is engulfed in strikes and protests over labor reform. News, feature reports, and more are at voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Most black holes are formed by the death and collapse of a star with a mass of about 20 times of our sun or more. But researchers who studied data gathered by NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, Spitzer and Hubble Space Telescopes, have found new evidence on how some of the biggest black holes in the universe may have formed. They discovered that some supermassive black holes may have been directly formed by the collapse of a gas cloud less than a billion years after the Big Bang, nearly 14 billion years ago. If proven correct, this process would have had to skip a number of steps that normally form a black hole. It was thought that supermassive black holes start off small and then grow at a rapid rate by accumulating surrounding material or merging with other black holes. The new finding suggests that black holes may already be quite big when they're formed and then grow at a normal rate. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has widened his grip on the Knesset by signing a coalition arrangement with the Israel Beitenu party, giving the defense portfolio a party leader, Avigdor Lieberman, a controversial figure who once served as foreign minister. The elevation of Lieberman, a hardliner on the Palestinian issue, raised concern in Washington. Mark Toner, a U.S. State Department spokesman, noted reports from Israel describing the government as the most right-wing coalition in Israel's history.
We also know that many of its ministers have said they oppose a two-state solution. This raises legitimate questions about the direction it may be headed in and what kind of policies it may adopt. But ultimately, we're going to judge this government based on its actions. We're going to work with this government as we have with every Israeli government that preceded it, with the goal of strengthening our cooperation. And we remain steadfast in our commitment to the security of Israel and then our commitment to working towards a two-state solution.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, following the resignation of Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, insisted his government is committed to the two-state solution. Russell Stone, a professor at American University's Center for Israel Studies, told VOA's Victor Beatty, Mr. Netanyahu faced a wafer-thin one-seat majority in parliament that proved to be unstable.
In order to do it, there were two choices, to move toward a coalition with the more centrist Labor Party or to move to the right-wing Israel Home, Israel Beitenu Party, led by Lieberman and supported largely by Russian recent immigrants to Israel. Lieberman lives in a settlement in the West Bank, and as such, is on principle not committed to a two-state solution, but to maintaining Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories. So that part was of concern to the American government. On the other hand, there were statements from the Department of Defense that they look forward to working with him as defense minister. Now, previously, he'd held a cabinet post as foreign minister. And in that government, both the Americans and the Israeli leadership had kind of isolated him. He never got deeply involved in foreign relations with major allies. Instead, his beat was the former Soviet Union countries in Eastern Europe. Subsequently, Netanyahu took over the foreign ministry post himself, which he continues to hold. So he's both prime minister and foreign minister.
Why do you think Mr. Netanyahu went to the right rather than to the center to widen his coalition?
It was an expedient. He had to probably give up less going to the right than to the center. It may be more consistent with his, on the one hand, stating that he's committed to a two-state solution, but not really willing to go forward with it.
It's made some impression on the State Department about the legitimate questions that it raises about the commitment to the two-state solution. Are there?
Yes. If you take the official stand, no. He says he's committed to it and that there's no viable partner to work with on the Palestinian side. If you look at his actions and this recent political act, no, he's not.
And what do you think the direction of the Israeli government will be going forward?
Probably not too much different from what it already is.
Russell Stone says the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship will remain strong. Coming up on International Edition, child Hiroshima survivors visit a moment of happiness from their past. And Above and Beyond changes its ways. President Barack Obama will visit Hiroshima, Japan, Friday. He's the first American president to do so while in office. In August 1945, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the city to force Japan's surrender in World War II. Although their city lay in ruins, some Hiroshima schoolchildren drew remarkable pictures showing hope and peace. The former students and their drawings are now part of a documentary called Pictures from a Hiroshima Schoolyard. VOA's Deborah Block has been following this story and joins us on the line right now. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, tell me, first of all, what are these pictures like?
These drawings are really charming. These were elementary school children, and they were drawing things like, you know, playing with their friends, putting flowers in, playing with dogs, playing games. And their city was in ruins. So a lot of these things weren't really real at that time. They were very colorful, and they really showed messages of hope and peace. They did those drawings that way because their teacher had told them to create some happy images. So these young students thought, well, what would make me happy in life? So they did drawings that they felt would make them happy and perhaps lead the way to a better future.
How did this film come about?
Well, the film was developed a few years ago by local people in Washington, one of Japanese heritage who was born in Hiroshima. She saw these pictures, these drawings, in the basement of Old Souls Church in Washington, D.C. Those pictures had been in the basement in a box for quite a few years, really largely forgotten. And as soon as the co-producer of the film, Shizumi Shigeto Minale, saw them, she thought, we have to do a film on this. This is an incredible find. And so the pictures were brought out, they were restored, and eventually they were sent back to the elementary school, which, believe it or not, is still standing today. The concrete outside managed to survive the atomic blast. And then the inside has been done over the years. And then these now aged students who were now 70 years and up got to see these pictures that they hadn't seen since they were children.
And what kind of response did they have?
Oh, the response was just overwhelming by a lot of them. Some of them laughed, remembering that they drew them and really remembering in some ways that they had had a good childhood despite the ruins of their city, and in many cases, losing parents and loved ones. Others were in tears. Again, thinking back to those times. Another woman said in the film that she had put things in her drawing that really weren't in existence at that moment, and that she wished that such things existed, which is why she drew them.
Isn't it amazing that these little kids in all the ruins and losing family members and all the horror that was around them, that they could reach inside of themselves and think of peace and love?
You know, Susan, that's really what the idea of this entire film is about. It's about children and forgiveness and looking forward. When I spoke with the co-producer, Shizumi, she said that Japanese culture really has a huge feeling about forgiveness, that if you don't forgive, you just remain bitter. So the thinking of many people, even though the city had been destroyed, even though people had been killed and hurt, was to think ahead, to think we can either hold this in our hearts and be bitter, or we can think of a better future and try to move on to a better world, which is peaceful.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah, for sharing this story with us.
You're welcome, Susan.
For more on this documentary, read Deborah's story on our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? How about some new skin, or more accurately, a second skin? Scientists at Harvard and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology say they are developing a new material which may reduce wrinkles and eye bags. MIT's Robert Langer says a polymer is rubbed on the skin along with a second coating of a different material that strengthens the polymer underneath. The result is an imperceptibly thin artificial second skin that could have a variety of uses.
Where you'd use it to tighten skin in different parts of the body. Another could be for therapeutics, where you'd use it as a whole new kind of plastic ointment that could be used to deliver drugs to the skin to treat different skin diseases. So there's all kinds of different directions you could take this discovery.
This facelift in a bottle that's supposed to keep your skin young, vibrant, and wrinkle-free is still being tested, with no word on when it might be available to the public. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
They're known for their pulse-pounding trance tracks, but now the British-based trio Above and Beyond is touring with total acoustic setup. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the three DJs have traded turntables and headphones for harps, pianos, and guitars.
Most of the time when you attend an Above and Beyond show, you get something like this. That's what the trio, John O'Grant, Tony McGinnis, and Paavo Siljamaki, brought to more than 1 million people on a beach in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. But it's their acoustic recordings that have gotten them into some of the most prestigious venues in the world. They released an unplugged album featuring some of their hits 2 years ago to good success. However, Paavo Siljamaki says the group wanted to do more.
It left us with a real sort of itch to do it again. It felt like we hadn't done enough, or it was nicer than we had initially predicted to play together, and then to have an audience like we had at the Greek really made sense of it all. So that was really why we decided to do acoustic, to really to have a chance to do it again.
During their current tour, the band has sold out the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California, the Sydney, Australia Opera House, and the Hollywood Bowl. Electronic DJs usually cannot play such venues because of volume restrictions. But Tony McGinnis says the acoustic concerts have opened a door the group never thought it would go through.
We sort of Trojan horse our way into some of these incredibly prestigious venues. I mean, we walked on stage at the Greek Theater having only done 4 gigs, really. And what band gets to do the Greek Theatre after doing 4 gigs? I can't think of any, you know. We kind of leapfrogged all that kind of years of training around the small clubs by bringing our electronic audience to these acoustic venues.
We were in heaven, you and I. And when I lay with you and close my eyes, our fingers touch the sky.
That report from David Byrd. He's here in Washington with us. And we'd like you to follow us on Twitter if you can. Our address is VOA_IE. If you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, just come on by our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab and then scroll down to International Edition. And thanks for joining us today.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Isnilan Hapalan is a fugitive who was wanted in connection with the May 2001 kidnapping of 20 people, including 3 Americans, in Palawan, the Philippines. A Philippine citizen, Hapalan is approximately 45 years old, has a thin build, stands 165 centimeters tall, and has black hair, brown eyes, and occasionally wears a slight mustache. He is also known as Abu Bakr Hapalan, Ahmad Hai Omar, and Bakal. Hapalan is a senior leader of the Abu Sayyaf Group, a terrorist organization operating in the southern Philippines that is also integrated with the worldwide network of Islamic terrorists, including Al-Qaeda. In this capacity, he was deeply involved in the May 27, 2001 attack on the Dos Palmas Resort in Palawan in the Philippines. 20 individuals were kidnapped in the raid, including 3 Americans, 2 of whom were killed. For this and other acts, Hapalan was indicted in the District of Columbia for involvement in terrorist activities against U.S. nationals and other foreign nationals in and around the Republic of the Philippines. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to Hapalan's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.